from producers Matt Damon and Ben Affleck. Explore how art and music sustained hope during the siege of Sarajevo. Thanks in part to humanitarians and the band U2. Kiss the Future. New documentary now streaming exclusively on Paramount Plus. Go to Paramount Plus to try it free. Terms apply.
Fights are back, and we're just warming up. It's the State of Combat podcast on CBS Sports with your boy, the Brian Campbell, MMA, right back at you, coming off of UFC 249, right in the midst of UFC's ambitious three fight cards in eight crazy nights. They're back, baby. Trust me. Yeah, where's Andy? Are you here? Where are you?
I'm back. Trust me. I bet.
All of us are back, Andy. Thank you very much. Fired up to be back in your lives, back in your ear hole where we belong, and fired up to be back looking at the fallout from UFC 249 and setting the stage for Wednesday night's UFC Fight Night Jacksonville. I don't know what we're calling it. It's just Fight Night Jacksonville Part 2, I guess. It's Sugar Rashad Evans, your Hall of Famer, your earthquake survivor. He's standing in the Hall of Fame. Wow, how's that for a ball? Rashad, welcome back to the pod. How you feel like we got a little bit of normalcy because of Uncle Dana and company? You feeling that?
I'm feeling a normalcy come back. You know, I'm feeling like things are going to start to return back to normal. That was a good sign this weekend, and good fights for the guys, man. They went out there and they fought amazing. I'm very happy with this weekend.
It was a fantastic fight card. And it wasn't just the feeling of, like, I've missed this in my life. It wasn't just the feeling of, damn, this is a loaded card. Like, that can still fail. They freaking brought it. I mean, I feel like every fight, it was either fight of the night contender or there was some kind of weird, you know, storyline coming out. Like, everyone delivered. The announce team brought it. We'll get into it. Not everything was perfect in terms of handling by the UFC this weekend. But, it seems like everything's come off pretty well. I feel like the momentum is going to keep going. And Rashad, I'm down with that, all right? I'm down with taking a bite out of the normal apple once again, okay? You know what I'm saying here?
I hear you, BC. I hear you, man.
All right, yes. Let's get excited. Let's get freaky.
But black folks love me, man. Black girls love me, too, man. I get hit on by black girls all the time.
Yep. Well,
I'll be like, ooh, I'll be showing my nipple. I'll be doing my nipple dance.
Okay, that's a little too far there. Rampage, we've also got a great guest for you today. Meathead, Matt Mitrione. Back on the pod, going to get you fired up for this ongoing collaboration between CBS Sports and Bellator. It's going to be every Wednesday night on your CBS Sports Network. Bellator MMA Recharged. Looking back at some great fights, including that heavyweight Grand Prix from a year ago. Rashad, that's aged pretty well, that heavyweight Grand Prix. That was fun business. Remember that?
It really was fun business. They need to do more stuff like that, though. I think that's the kind of stuff that can bring in the attention that they need to the organization, you know?
Absolutely. We were also doing some work with Showtime, chatting with Scott Coker about the heavyweight Grand Prix he did with Strikeforce back in the day. People forget, Rashad, when he rolled out Fedor, Overeem, Verdum, like bang, bang, bang. Like that was, they had a better heavyweight division for a hot second than UFC at that point. Scott Coker, shout out, right? Shout out to
Yeah, absolutely. I think when organizations hop on that whole like tournament style, you know, how they do their belt structure, I think it ignites that attention. People want to see what's going to happen, and it draws you in because no matter what, you're going to be brought to a finale, and it's going to be exciting no matter who's in it. So I think they need to do more stuff like that. It gives the attention to the weight classes that they need, and it gives a good showcase for all the fighters in there, you know?
And everybody loves a good finale.
It was a good finish. I like a good finish.
Whoa, Carl Froch. Whoa, Cobra. Back down there for a second. All right, Rashad, not only is MMA back in our lives, but you have to feel like pro sports is going to follow. And hey, fantasy football fans. Rashad, you a fantasy football guy, or is that a little too nerdy for you?
Nah, I did a fantasy football a few times. It's all right, hey, man.
Remember when you won your league with LaDainian Tomlinson in 06? Well, maybe it wasn't you. But remember when someone out there did? Remember when you won your league with Randy Moss in 07 when he was catching like 50 touchdown passes? Or when you were the only guy who bought into Peyton Hillis after his big season? Well, all this week, Rashad, I want to get you ready for this. The Fantasy Football Today podcast is becoming fantasy football yesterday. They're going to look back at the best and worst seasons of the last 20-plus years of fantasy football, the Mount Rushmores at each position, the biggest breakouts or busts. Well, that's a hell of a bust. Yeah, very impressive. And all the best memories from fantasy football since the late 90s. Relive it this week for 5 episodes with Fantasy Football Yesterday on the Fantasy Football Today podcast. Maybe one day they'll come out with the Fantasy Football Tomorrow job. Maybe I should patent that first. It's available wherever you find fine audio. Rashad, I started playing fantasy football, by the way, in 1990. I'm an OG. 90, brother.
OG in the game.
I was drafting like Jim Everett and Rodney Hampton. And yeah, these are like some old Andre Ware. Remember that guy, the Heisman
Trophy? Oh, yeah.
Talking about. All right. People don't come here, though, to hear our takes on fantasy football. They want to hear the real deal Holyfield that was UFC 249 this weekend. Just a reminder, everyone, if you're not woke to what Rashad and I are doing on CBS Sports HQ, right after the fights, we're going live. A lot of great previews, analysis, stuff. You're going to hear us this week as well. But, Rashad, for anyone that missed your hot takes, Broham, Justin Gaethje stole the damn show by walking through the fire against Tony Ferguson, stopping him in round 5. We're certainly going to look at what's next. But how do you sort of frame what that damn magician, Trevor Whitman, your coach, has done to help Justin be the best he can be?
You know, it was beautiful. It was destructive. It was a good game plan, you know, and it was headed by those leg kicks. Those heavy leg kicks really was the thing that helped Justin Gaethje land those powerful shots and get to those angles, because it ruined Tony's motion. You know, Tony's a good fighter who likes to move and works really good at moving forward. But when Justin Gaethje chopped those legs down, it pretty much destroyed him in every single asset, because he couldn't move no more. He couldn't stand and plant and strike no more. And even when he was trying to initiate his grappling exchanges, he no longer had explosion. So just with destroying that leg, and Justin Gaethje can kick super hard, he was able to just solidify the fight. And then at that point, he was able to get to the angles and land these powerful shots. And hats off to Tony Ferguson being able to take the kind of punishment. You know,
it was a sickening level of I'm gonna risk it all. Like, I'm gonna pour the damn jug out, Rashad. Like that. Like, we got to put that in a time capsule. That was maybe the most manly, you know, for better or for worse, that was the most man we've ever seen in one octagon.
I mean, I will say this. It's like, when you're a fighter, you always want to go out on your sword. Like, going out on your sword is the thing to do if you know you're losing a fight. You know what I'm saying? And it's just it's part of the sport. And the way he accepted the fact that this could be it for him, and he was like, you know what, I'm not gonna cower down, I'm not gonna quit. And he kept going forward, and he kept taking the punishment and didn't want to stop. That's strong mentality, because a lot of people would have been looking for the way out, but you were going to have to kill Tony Ferguson in that fight.
And that's why, even if you're going to play the card of, well, you know, Tony Ferguson shouldn't have made weight 2 weeks ago, or Tony Ferguson was preparing for Habib for 6 months and then he had to switch gears. And I'm not saying some of that stuff didn't factor in, just like it's an unprecedented time with the COVID, not knowing where the fight was going to be. All that matters. But yet at the same time, I'm not using any of that as a crutch to take away what Justin Gaethje did, because I really feel like, Rashad, although you can maybe criticize why didn't Ferguson go to the ground more, why not this or that, I feel like Gaethje got the best version of 36-year-old Tony Ferguson that you're going to get. I mean, he buckled and dropped him with an uppercut to end round 2, and that uppercut from Ferguson would have finished anybody. And the fact that Gaethje was able to not only recover, but stay poised within the violent structure of what he does well. This may be the best performance in terms of saying, look, he's still swinging for the fences every time, but he never got reckless. He never got gassed out. He was able to somehow take this extremely heavy, violent attack and almost make it technical. Rashad, yeah, you can't do that. That's like, you can't have a freak and bring her home to mom. If they don't go together like that, right? You know what I'm saying?
It was very oxymoronic, his fighting style, and especially the way after the fight, you know, there wasn't that any visible damage. He wasn't damaged as much, even though he did take some pretty good shots and an uppercut, you indicated, sent him to the ground, but there wasn't that beating on his face or on his body. You know, you can see it was definitely a landslide on his side. And, you know, for me, though, I think that with Tony Ferguson, and I thought this at the time, when Tony Ferguson made a couple weeks ago, you know, I thought it was a great thing as far as a mentality standpoint and being able to make sure that he's going to finish the job he started to do. But on the back end of that, when you bring your body to cut weight and you are trying to get your peak your body for an event, by bringing your body to cut weight, you can actually peak your body too early. And he might have peaked his body too early, not making an excuse for him, but at the end of the day, that may just be the reality of the situation. And when I was breaking down the analysis of the fight, that was one of the things that kept sticking in my mind, the starting and stopping of camps. Because I had a camp like that where it starting and stopped and started and stopped. And I felt as if like I peaked a little bit too early. And then when I actually had a fight, I didn't have the same fire as I thought I would have had a few weeks ago when I was supposed to fight.
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm not going to say none of that counted, but I'm going to say that Tony somehow broke through that. And I felt like, I mean, like, look, again, we can't go any further without saying Tony Ferguson ate like 30 knockout shots, like the kind of shots that people just fall. And he never went down, or he went down to his knee for a second. And yet, so it's like, even if all that is true and he compromised himself in certain areas, he fought hard enough that it was as if, like, you can't lean on that. It's as if, like you got to give Justin Gaethje his credit. And, you know, and I don't want to overflow Coach Whitman here, but, like, he took Rose Namajunas, one of my favorite fighters ever. Love her skill set, her demeanor, her style, and helped her figure out the very best she could be. I know she got dropped on her head against Jessica Andrade, but, Rashad, that round one was, like, perfection of who she could be as a boxer from the outside, all that great stuff. What he's doing with Justin Gaethje right now, it's incredible. Shout out to Coach. I mean, it
really is. And, you know, when I got knocked out by Machida, for me to get my confidence back and to get my winning ways back, I went to Trevor Whitman. And Trevor Whitman, you know, he broke down my whole skills and built them back up in a way that made it so that I understood, you know, the angles that I needed to be on and what was my fighting game, my fighting style. And I really, really flourish underneath Coach Whitman because of his coaching style and the fact that he's able to make you a teacher by his teaching style. You know, the way he educates you, it makes you so you're able to correct yourself when he's not around. You know, he really makes it a cerebral game and he makes you a better fighter. And I see the same thing with Justin Gaethje. You know, I was talking to Justin Gaethje weeks and weeks before this, and he was talking to me about the angles that he was getting on. He was showing me some examples and some traps, how Trevor showed him how to set. And it's just like, you know, that's that perfect mindset that you get from a coach like Trevor Whitman that's been in the game for a long time.
Shout out to Justin Gaethje. I took the L publicly a few times and said, look, I didn't think it was possible that he could be this good, meaning that he could, like, figure out how to be a little bit more poised and technical without losing who he was. And he figured it out. Now his ceiling is huge from the idea of, I can't count him out against Habib. This is a super fight. I mean, this is going to be a badass fight if and when they make this. The last thing I want to say about Tony, though, before moving to what's next, is the lament here. He took a chance. We talked about it. He took a chance by fighting Justin when he could have just said, sorry, I'm never going to fight again until the title's in front of me and Habib's right there, right? He chose the other way of, no one's going to carve my path for me. You need me to fight for this interim title against this psycho? I'm doing it. Now, look, shout out to the man there, but the 12-fight win streak is over. What they were building to against Habib is over. 5 times over. Should we mourn that this may end up going down as, like, it's very few times in UFC history, credit to the organization, that we don't get the fights we want or deserve, right? The short list is so short that you're like, okay, Randy Couture and Fedor, but only because Fedor's team drove up the price and were hard to deal with. And maybe like GSP, Anderson Silva. Besides that, or maybe John Jones, Rumble Johnson, because Jones got arrested. Besides that, we get everything we want. This is Christmas morning. It's never going to be what it was. Tony versus Habib. Will you mourn that, please, for the people here? I mean, I feel like we got to pour one out for our homies. It was going to be special, Rashad.
It was going to be one for the ages. And, you know, the fight fan in me, it deeply mourns that fight because I know that in that fight we would have seen a classic. I know in that fight we would have seen something that we would have never seen. I know in that fight we would have seen something like we've seen on Saturday night, you know. And I think that, you know, forever we're going to be wishing and hoping and I guess kind of wondering what would have happened if those two would have met in their primes. And I don't think that their paths will cross again at this moment where there will be, you know, a match like this. You know, I think that Tony Ferguson, you know, 36 years old and you know, now I don't want to say he's on the back end of his career or nothing like that. But at the same time, you know, where his trajectory may be going versus where Habib's maybe just on age alone and physical ability, based on that age, you know, he may not have too much longer. So, you know, it's a young man's sport. And when you look at that, it does get sad to see that fight never actually materialize. And it was made like 8 times.
It's incredible. It's sad. It's incredible. I still think, and you know, I'll go to my grave with this. I still think Tony Ferguson was the guy. If somebody, you know, and it may end up being Justin Gaethje. For all we know, Conor McGregor could get back into Superman mode and maybe be Habib, maybe not.
But yeah, I mean that's a little too much.
Okay, it's a little too much. I don't know.
Who knows?
But I feel like Tony was really, really the only guy. I mean, you know,
rip that suit off. Show everyone your S.
Well, which S? What I'm saying is Tony, I thought, was the only guy. But, we, you know, stuff happens. And now we probably, or at least we should, have Justin Gaethje against Khabib Nurmagomedov. Shout out to your guy, Ali Abdelaziz, because he was the real MVP on Saturday night between Joe, Justin, Khabib, and all that. He's got everybody in-house as well as yourself. But Khabib's doing Ramadan through May 23rd. He said he'd probably be back in August. Justin just did 5 rounds of hell. I know he wasn't too banged up, but I mean, come on. He went 5 rounds with Tony Ferguson. He's not coming back next month. Right. So that has to be next. It should be next.
I think it's the most responsible thing for it to be next.
Damn right it should be next. But when you have Conor McGregor in the bullpen, all bets are off, and you know this man, okay?
I know
that when we're going to talk Conor, and I know that when you're talking Conor, like, he averaged in his big fights, he averages between $7 and $11 million live gate. So if you're UFC, you do have to ask yourself, like, is it worth doing empty arena or maybe wait in 6 months? You know, like, they got that problem to figure out. But Conor jumped the gun yesterday with a barrage of tweets in which he ripping everybody. Like, if you ever came across him, he's calling you out. He said he would butcher Justin Gaethje. He went on to restart up the Khabib fight, which led to Khabib coming back at him. He's killing Dustin Poirier. I mean, he's just killing people. But what's interesting is, you know, Ali was trying to get – he was trying to have his cake and eat it too. He was trying to get Conor to want to go to Justin Gaethje, thinking that Justin was going to be on the outside looking in, and then the winner fight Khabib. Now suddenly Conor's going, I'll fight Justin, and I'll butcher him, and then the winner gets Khabib. How do you gauge – what Conor's trying to do publicly? I mean, for all we know, he could have had a couple shots deep of proper 12 and just been talking shit. But, like, how do you gauge what just happened in the last 24 hours?
I mean, listen, Conor is a genius when it comes to marketing himself and making sure the conversation never leaves him, you know, and that's what this is about. He doesn't want the conversation to leave him. He wants to grab onto that moment of Justin Gaethje, but, hey, listen, throw his name in the hat. And truthfully speaking, that's a smart move by him. You know, he should be trying to throw his name in the hat. But from speaking to Ali, his manager, Ali's like, listen, we offered Conor that fight before he took the fight with Donald. But he wanted, as Ali said, he wanted the easier fight. And
it's the closest thing to a tune-up fight for him. It was.
Yeah, it was an easier fight. And then now that Justin Gaethje has momentum and had a great fight, now he wants to fight him. And Ali is just like, you know, sit down, because when it was your turn to be this guy, you didn't want to be that guy, you know? So I get that respect, but I also get Conor trying to make it so that, hey, my name never leaves your mouth. You know what I'm saying? Always on your mind.
Yeah, Conor always in play here. I will say that, so it should be Justin. I hope it will be Justin. I think it will be Justin. But you do have to understand that, you know, Dana White was on the CBS Sports HQ and on this podcast last week. And I asked him, you know, a lot of people talking about Endeavor and money, and that's why you're pushing to come back. And, you know, he shot it down. He said, those people are idiots. They have no idea. Look, honestly, I think there's some element there of realness. So with that, at any point, they may decide to cash in that lottery ticket. They may go, you know what? Khabib Conor 2 is going to break every record possible. Why are we waiting around? So you have to understand that is in play.
Right. That is that. I mean, and especially this, you know, you take the, you were talking about what he does at a live gate. Now imagine those people that are that feverish for him at home now. Now they're going to buy it up, you know, and that's going to be huge numbers. That's going to be like the kind of pay-per-view numbers that they used to get back in the day before they started giving away a lot of free shows, you know?
Glad you brought that up, because there was a lot. I was on a bunch of radio shows heading into last week, and, you know, the debate was, what do you think this pay-per-view is going to do? Only game in town, loaded card. And I was like, look, I don't think it's going to do incredible. I think it'll do solid. And the reason was because, look, in boxing or MMA, in pay-per-view history, people buy stars. That's why in boxing, there's no good fights under the main event. Why? Because they, right, there's no reason to in their mind. You only buy it because of Floyd or Oscar or Manny or Floyd and Oscar against each other or Manny. You know what I mean? Like, that's right, how that game works. It is true like that in UFC. Loaded cards don't necessarily mean you're getting another 500,000 pay-per-view buys. So I had questions. The early numbers that have been put out, did you see those?
No, I haven't seen them yet. 700,000
pay-per-view buys. And you have to understand, in the ESPN Plus era, that's even more impressive because do traditional pay-per-view, it's getting promoted every channel you turn on everywhere because the pay-per-view company, you know, whatever your cable company is, they want in on it. They're getting a cut of this. They're promoting the balls out of it. In the ESPN Plus era, it's only getting promoted on ESPN.
Right.
And they did 700,000 buys. Rashad, in the year of our Lord 2020, that's badass. That shows you that the hunger is there.
It definitely is, and especially like you said, you know, with everything you have to do to even get the whiff of there being a UFC, it's just not like, you know, like coming on randomly and stuff like that. So you do have to go out of your way more, the average person, to be able to take part in a UFC event, and those are some strong numbers, and that shows a good indication that the people are thirsty. They want this. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. The people need this. It's something that. And I hate to say need, but when you think about this, when you think about the fact that so much of our life, everything is psychological, you know, and if psychologically speaking, you can't get your mind around anything normal, you can't, you know, find that place in your side to reset yourself, then you're not going to do well on any aspect. And I think that for a lot of people, this is what fighting brings to them.
That's true. That's true. I do have to finish on this Conor subject and get your opinion here, because he's going to have to fight somebody. So here's the deal. Justin deserves it. Let's say they go in the Justin direction. Conor kind of pump faked the world on Friday. I don't know if you saw this. Dana put something out on Instagram. Nate Diaz responded with like a jab at him. And then Conor responded to Nate, like, sign the contract, Nathan. Like, let's go. And everybody's like, whoa, that would make a lot of sense. If you want to do Khabib Justin because Justin deserves it, you want to keep Conor busy in a big fight that would attract an audience, but is kind of in its own world, right? About Nate Diaz at welterweight, it's in its own world. Dana, though, subsequently late Saturday said there's absolutely no truth to that. They're just talking shit, basically. What do you do with Conor McGregor right now? Because there was a day last week we thought maybe he gets Jorge Masvidal, but again, I'm going to put out there, while that is a monster night at the box office for UFC, right? Masvidal could hurt him bad. So you do have to be careful. Like, ideally, if Justin gets Khabib next, then you best believe UFC wants Conor to fight the winner. Like, you bet your ass they want Conor to fight the winner. So what do you do with Conor in the meantime, Rashad? Get your Dana White hat on and tell me.
I think you just got to, like, hold Conor down a little bit and just kind of, you know, get him to relax a little bit. I think that if you put him in positions where he wants to be right now, I don't think it's going to get him where he wants to be right now, if that makes any sense. You know what I'm saying? I think if he wants to fight with Justin Gaethje, I don't think he's going to make it to the fight with Khabib. And you know what I'm saying? So I think that you have to harness him a little bit and just kind of understand that, you know, a lot of these matchups may be a big risk for him if he wants that big pay-per-view. And taking a fight with Diaz, yeah, that's a fun fight, but that may be another fight that takes him further away from the idea that he should be even in the conversation with a Justin or a Khabib, you know? So I think that what you need to do is, I think you just need to just keep Conor at bay right now, keep him training, keep him, you know, on the straight and narrow, because unless you feed him somebody who is going to be something that he can actually do some work with, you know what I'm saying? Somebody
like
can
an
work
Anthony
with.
Pettis? How about that? Like an Anthony Pettis who just beat Cowboy?
Like an Anthony Pettis, somebody who's going to get some attention, somebody who's going to go in there and give a good effort, somebody who's going to, you know, fight, but, you know, not beat him.
That's a fair point. And I know, look, there's people that are listening to this, Rashad, that don't think about, don't care about, or don't like the business aspect. They're like, what are you guys talking about? Why are you going to protect Conor? Well, dude, like, you got to be, like, you got to understand how the game works. It's an entertainment business. UFC would protect Conor. Hell yeah, they would. You got to understand, when he fights Khabib a second time, it's going to, like, they'll make enough money for 3 years worth. I mean, seriously, like, that's how the business works. You build toward the super fight. So you can't, there's only so much risk you can do. But wow, business is blooming here. Let's get your take a couple days later now on that co-main event. Henry Cejudo stops Dominic Cruz. Yes, somewhat questionable stoppage there, but it felt like it was going in that direction. Cejudo retires. Rashad, you and I both in the immediate aftermath were like, you know, I don't think he's retiring there. This seems like a power play. I gave you the take that I think it's not just I want to get paid more. I think he's smarter in him and Ali than we even realize. It's like, I'm going to give you back the Bantamweight belt so I have no obligation to fight Peter Yan, Sanhagen, you know, all those guys in Aljamain in a row, and I can just sit back and take whatever small weight super fight I can find, including maybe Alexander Volkanovski for a third championship. I think that's the reality. And then when Cejudo goes in that press conference and is like, quote, Dana knows the number that will bring me back, I don't think – I mean, what – Come on now, right?
The guy's not going anywhere. Come on now. No, he's not going anywhere. And listen, Henry Cejudo, it seems as if even though he has tons of accomplishments and he could walk away with this just on a basis that he's accomplished so much in so many different sports, but there's something different about this sport that with his accomplishments, it's like he's finding himself on another level. You know, you kind of see Henry Cejudo growing up in front of your eyes. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, you've seen, you know, he's got a girl now and all those things. And you can kind of see his mentality changing, you know, and he's finding himself. He's finding his trash talking and all that thing. So those are things that, you know, that he's finding in himself. And you just don't give that away. You just don't like, all right, I'm done. I'm going to let that go. No, you built something there. You're just not going to let that go. So I think that goes to say, you know, his whole call that I'm going to retire, I think that was just a strategy to be like, I need to get more money. You know, he wants to be making some serious money for his accolades and everything like that. And I think, you know, he is worth the money, but he's doing what he needs to do to make himself exciting and make himself something that people want to talk about, and doing things like saying things, I'm going to retire and things like that. Those are things that make people like, oh my gosh, what's going on with Henry? What's going on with Henry? And keep his name in a lot of people's mouths.
All right, I got a couple quick follow-ups here. I'll ask you a hard question here. He has a lot of value to UFC because that Mexican-American fan base, which has carried boxing forever, UFC's never really been able to hit that thing hard, right? Cain Velasquez was great, but wasn't the guy for that. Shout out to Brown Pride. They haven't been able to find that person. He's that person. He could be that person. But there are some people who – so that's him saying, look, I know my value. I know what I could be. I want super fights all the time. I want big-time money. Do that for me. In a lot of ways, again, that's the one way he pulled leverage on UFC, which is basically saying, I already won your title. It has no meaning to me now. Take it back. I support his gamemanship there. But do you think there's any talk about this? To get popular, he had to become like a weirdo cringe guy. And look, it's a shtick. It worked. We talk about him. It worked. But like, is that the true essence of where his marketing could have gone as a American Olympic gold medalist with a Latino background who in real life is like a baby face. In real life, he's a great dude who didn't cut corners and did everything right. And it's, Rashad, sometimes it's that debate we get in the African-American community in boxing, specifically around Floyd Mayweather, where he found success pissing people off purposely by being a villain. And then we feel like as white guy pundits, if every black fighter after him doesn't take that same position, we go, oh, they're not marketable. Terrence Crawford, not marketable. Sorry, right? Does Cejudo have to do this to get famous?
No, I don't think he has to do this, but I think it's something, a societal thing. I don't think that society, they're cheering for the good guy anymore. They're not, you know, cheering for the guy who's done all the accomplishments, because it's no fun in that. That's boring. That's boring to a lot of people, you know, the clean cut guy, that's boring. They want somebody with more edge, because that to them symbolizes a real person and what realness is about. Mm-hmm. So when Henry comes and he's being real or just kind of being corny or whatever the case may be, he's showing a bit of vulnerability. But in that vulnerability that he's showing that he's a person. And you know, and I think that's where, you know, people can kind of relate or kind of connect, or the fact that he just kind of knocks himself down a little bit when he looks corny, so it may make him more approachable to fans. Who knows? But whatever the case may be, people have a hard time resonating with the good guy. And I think that goes to speak more of what's going on in society versus a thing with Henry.
All right, to close on the Cejudo part of this factor, are there fights that we're not thinking of below lightweight that can actually become like destination super fights for him? Now, look, if he had a chance at that featherweight title to become the first three-division champ, that's a great story. I'm sure he would prefer Volkanovski, who's short in stature, and it would be a better matchup for him. Dana just came out publicly and said, I'm going to make Max Holloway Volkanovski too. Are there any names out there that he could really milk? I mean, it's different when you're fighting Dom Cruz or Aldo when you have the belt. As right. just an individual, like, is there actually a market for him to become what he wants to be?
I think so. I think there is a market. You know, I think in that weight class spectrum between, you know, that 135 and 140, I think there's a lot of synergy there. I think there's a lot of good guys there who are pretty even, you know, pretty even. And, you know, the guys at 145, you know, they're a lot like the guys at 135, but just a lot bigger and a lot taller, you know, and that's one thing that we you know, I mean, he's used to being the smallest guys, but we don't know how big that size difference can be. You know, how big can he overcome a guy being bigger than him? You know, what's the limit?
But outside of chasing a title, are there actually enough older established names that people would care about? Like, if he's trying to fight Frankie Edgar, would people care? If he's trying to fight Uriah Faber, would people care?
They wouldn't care. They wouldn't care, to be honest. No.
It's interesting. I mean, some people are, I mean, these are casuals. Casual people are like, well, why can't he just meet Conor McGregor at a catchweight? Come on, people. Get out of that. I wanted to hit one thing on Dominic Cruz, who I felt like, you know, shout out to Dominic Cruz. 3.5, 4 years removed from the game. He came in very game. It was Cejudo's leg kicks that really kind of closed the door on Cruz's path to potential victory. But Cruz, who is such an inspirational figure, such a guy I respect so much. In fact, I respect him too much so that he was talking me into thinking he can pull this upset on Saturday. He flipped the script and was like, not only did Keith Peterson, the referee, screw me, but the dude smelt like alcohol and cigarettes and wouldn't look me in the eye during the pre-fight meeting when I tried to tell him that I need to be knocked out to lose. This is a championship fight. I'm going for it. Don't stop the fight. He says Peterson not only wouldn't look him in the eye, but this was the first time he ever had a referee who he just felt like maybe this guy was out in the parking lot, you know, with a – like this is the type of comments like Alistair felt it, Stipe tapped, right? You hear that from Alistair?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Really, guy? This doesn't – Cruz had a chance to fix it on the Ariel Helwani show yesterday. And he doubled down. Oh. What's going on here, Rashad?
I don't know. You know, honestly, it's unfortunate because he's such a good voice in the space when it comes to giving his analytical opinion and everything else like that. But then this, you know, not being able to do it, be able to take self-criticism or being able to criticize yourself in the same capacity in which you've done others, it doesn't bode well for you in the future when you want to make comments about other people, you know, and that's one thing that, you know, that you have to think of when you're now, when you're an analyst and whenever you're in put in a position where you have to fight and you lose. You know, whenever I was in a fight and I lost, it was my turn to wear the hat. And I had to remember everything that I said about everybody else when they lost. And in turn, I had to wear it on myself. I had to, you know, watch videos of myself getting knocked out and then sit there and interview or talk to the guy or talk about the guy as, you know, about him knocking me out. And that's just part of the sport, part of being an analyst. And I think that what Dom is doing is that he's in his emotion. And I think once he gets emotional clarity, he's going to look back and be like, man, I really should have handled things differently. But he's just heartbroken, you know. And that heartbreak.
That's not him, though. That's
not
him.
It's not. It really isn't. It's not.
Like, and if there's any truth, like, look, I'm not going to sit here. Keith Pearson's a great referee. I mean, John Anik always does the no nonsense joke because that guy comes in there and gets his job done. I mean, if he actually believes that, then like, file a formal protest and go that route. Right. But like, to just sit here and whine, like, I expected him to come on Ariel Helwani yesterday and be like, I screwed up, guys. I was in my, you know, I was in my feelings. I was over emotional. I was competitive. I lost that fight. Instead, he's like, you know, give me my opportunity to get knocked out. you know, there's certain warriors that live by that code. And when they say that, like if a Jorge Masvidal said that, you're like, okay, I get it. Right. You're a badass. That's your thing. I didn't like that. I didn't like that.
I mean, when you're a referee in there and your job is to help, you know, to make sure someone doesn't get hurt too bad, you're not really like, you go in automatic mode. You know what I'm saying? You just know you're used to just preventing a situation. So when you see it, despite what that person may have told you, you're going to intervene just because it's become a natural instinct to you. You know, when you've roughed so many fights, you've turned so many things into just instincts, just because you need to. Whenever you do anything, you need to turn some things into instincts just so you'd be able to react in a moment's notice. And that, I mean, that's just part of the game. You know, sometimes you see referees call fights where you kind of can debate, but when you're making a moment, a decision in a moment's notice, you have to be able to, you know, do what you need to do for the protection of the fighter. And I think that's what Keith was doing.
It's a tough situation. The last bit of talk I wanted to do on 249 was that heavyweight bout when Francis Ngannou just freaking walked through Jair Rosenstruik in like 20 seconds. I mean, you and I talked about this on CBS Sports HQ. The dude just uncorked like a 7-punch combo and was like, deal with it. One of these is going to hit your chin and one of these is going to go off like a grenade. The story here is what happens next, but hit us up with what happened then. He might be the scariest individual at any single point in UFC history. That's a bold-ass statement, but, like, deal with it. Like, that's a scary MF-er, and now that he's mentally been through the fire of having lost and having lost his invincibility, he's more dangerous than ever before.
He really is, and I think, like you said, that deconstruction that he did, and now he's built himself up into – you know, something on a mental force, you know, that rivals his physicality. And I think that was missing before. And, you know, now, you know, you just seen the confidence in him just when he's standing in the cage. But, you know, when that fight started, he just went across the cage. He knew he didn't want to play the whole feeling out game or none of that. He just went in there and handled business and unleashed a combination. And the fact that he just threw caution through the wind, it just shows the confidence that he has in his hands to know that, yeah, I'm going to throw like this, but I know if I catch you, it's done, you know? And that's what, you know, the thing with Francis that makes him so scary is before we knew that he had that power, but now we know that he has that confidence that goes along with throwing those big, powerful punches. And that's dangerous for heavyweights, man. Super
that's
dangerous.
Scary as all heck. The real story is what happens next, because Ngannou's 4 consecutive first-round KOs against, let me remind you, like Curtis Blaydes, Cain Velasquez, Junior Dos Santos, and unbeaten Rosenstruik is insane. And it all came within like 71 seconds or less. So he needs a title shot. Problem, of course, is Stipe Miocic has no access to his gym. He wants to fight, or UFC wants him to fight DC in a trilogy bout next. Stipe has said on, you know, on this show last week, you know, I ain't fighting until I get the full training camp. Like, let's do this right. So here's the update on that. DC was funny during Saturday's broadcast and said, you know, I want Ngannou to get a title shot more than anyone, just not against me. He was joking, but like he was letting you know that like this guy's a beast. DC then did an interview with somebody where he was like, look, Stipe's not ready. I'll fight Ngannou for an interim title if I have to. Let's do it. So Stipe comes out on Twitter yesterday and goes, I've already said I'm going to fight DC. He just likes to make noise. My team is working on securing a training location and dates with UFC. I have 5 belts at home. I don't need to sit on anything. If I didn't have a torn retina, I would have fought and retired DC already. Love that. Love that energy. DC comes back a couple hours later with champ. That's perfect. That's all I want to hear. Just give me a date. That's it. Let us all know. You said in the fall. When in the fall is all we're asking. So Rashad, like as great as Ngannou has been, the fight to make is still, as you would say, Stipe DC 3. because like the winner's the best heavyweight in UFC history. Like this is Ali Frazier crap. This is great. But what do you do with Francis Ngannou in the meantime? I mean, can you put the guy in the bullpen? I don't know his financials. I can't say you're not fighting for 9 months. Like, what do we do here?
That's an interesting question because, you know, until Rosenstruik stepped up to fight him, he really had no one there to fight him, you know? So it's going to be a while. I don't really foresee anybody being in that position or even wanting to take that fight with him. And as far as the UFC is concerned, you know, they've run out of answers as far as what they can do with him in the meantime, because this fight with DC and Stipe is taking so long. But I mean, it's interesting. You know, I think that if you're Francis's team, you just keep him in the wings and you just work on all those things that he need to work on, you know, as far as, you know, making him that much better with wrestling, because you have to make him for the fight that he's potentially going to have. So he maybe had a fight with DC. So he should be working with somebody who's got that Olympic wrestling background, who can help him, you know, work on that chain wrestling that, you know, DC does to those punches and all that unorthodox jamming up style that DC's really known for and effectively known for. So I think that, you know, that's the move for Francis right now. And how long was he training before this fight? You know, what was it like? He was on a long training, you know, like, what was it, 7 months or something like that? A few months he was training for this one. So he's been waiting in the wings for a while.
Absolutely. Can't wait to see what's next. I could be here all day going fight by fight. We gotta roll on. But before I do, there was a little bit of controversy about, look, the UFC spent a lot of money to put on testing for this fight.
Yeah.
Every fighter got the blood test. They got the nose thing with the thing they jam into your brain. And Jacare ends up popping, you know, asymptomatic for it. And it was tough to see him and two members of his team. But the whole timeline thing was the debate, where Jacare told UFC ahead of time, I was exposed to a family member who had it. So they claim they had him sequestered alone. But yet you saw on Fabricio Verdum's Instagram video that, like, Jacare's high-fiving everyone and hanging out within like a foot away with a mask and gloves on. Look, I don't know what the deal is, but it seemed like he was exposed to many people before they figured out the results of his test. I don't know how long that takes. I'm not a epidemiologist and all that crap. But UFC afterwards came out and said, like, you know, everything was fine. He was, you know, immobilized by himself. Well, he wasn't. We saw it on the video. So if nothing bad comes out of this, they certainly learned a lesson on how to do it even better. Like, Ariel Helwani reported that they sent out a email to all the fighters, said, look, if you've been around even anyone with a sniff of this, let us know now before you drive or fly this way, which is smart. But were you okay with the way that whole thing was handled? Because it looks like in the UFC official statement, they were a little bit off. And again, I'm not here to, like, I'm not one of these media members that's trying to make the fights not happen. I want the fights. This is my, like, I want it. I do want everybody to be safe, though. You think they kind of dodged a bullet here with Jacare?
I think they did a really good job with Dirk Jacare as far as, you know, the way they handled the fight and everything like that. Because, listen, this whole thing is new, and this is the first sport back to business after that whole thing. So there's going to be some hiccups in a way, and no matter what organization, there would have been some unforeseen things that happen just because it's new. So I think despite all of that, I think the UFC, they did a really good job of handling that situation. And, you know, that is something that a lot of fighters are going to have to think about, you know, when they are signing these contracts for these camps. You know, do I have to go away to be in camp so that way I'm isolated and I'm not around anybody who can get me sick? You know, not being around family members and things like that. You know, I used to go and isolate myself at camp and go to Denver and Albuquerque when I did my camp, and I was away from my family. So some people may find that may help them. Who knows? But, you know, I think the UFC has definitely taken the right step to making sure that they're able to compete and make sure the fighters are safe while they're doing so.
Now, the only wild card to this, the asterisk, is the whole NDA, non-disparagement agreement contract that apparently all the fighters had to sign. It leaked out. Actually, Showtime Sports president Stephen Espinoza kind of leaked it out. Kevin Iole got a copy of it. He called up Dana. Dana said, this is normal. It's in every contract. It just says, if you lie about us, we could take away your purse and your bonuses. But if you put out, you know, criticism of us, that's fair. That's your opinion. Everything's okay. Well, people who have legal backgrounds actually researched the contract and were like, that's not what it says, Dana. It says basically if you say anything bad about them at all, they can come and take your money. Now, I want your take in a second. My take is, that's way too far. But look, it's an employer and employee relationship. You know, I've worked for different corporate companies, and there's certain things you can and can't say publicly when you're working for them. That's their issue. My issue is a little deeper with the fact that the media was forced to sign this upon entering. I think it's one thing to sign a paper that as a media member or fighter or trainer that says, if I catch COVID while I'm there, I'm not going to sue you. I'm taking a chance being there. That I agree with that 100%. Right. We're in uncertain, wild times. UFC should not be bound to that. But if you're having a media member sign something that says, I can't say something or I face this, that's like communism to me. Where do you stand? Because you're both an ex-fighter and a journalist now part of this media game. Is that copacetic to you? This is like, this ain't good. This ain't good to me. It smells funny, Rashad.
I think journalism has to be kept as journalism. You know, I don't think you can restrain journalism in that respect, because when you do that, it loses its point. You know what I'm saying? It's just not journalism anymore. So I think that I don't think that they should be doing that, but I think that they people should, you know, be responsible and held accountable for what they do right. You know, I think that, you know, if somebody does put out something hellacious and not true, then they should have to be held accountable for that. But at the same time, being told what the right is never a good recipe for freedom.
Yeah, and what about the fighter aspect? Are you okay with that from a fighter standpoint?
For a fighter standpoint, you know, because of the conditions and because they're trying to pull this off when, you know, truthfully speaking, you know, they can make it so that we're all sitting at home or, you know, not doing anything, then I can understand that, because they're trying to do something and they're taking a huge risk legally wise by doing so. So they have to protect themselves on a legal basis, because if they don't do that, then they can find the UFC organization being taken by whoever, you know what I'm saying? So I do understand that. And I think that the fighters should do that if they want to fight.
And look, I understand that, like, even in the concept of journalism, things have changed. When you have TV networks that have stakes in the game, ESPN has a stake in a UFC succeeding. Right. So there's a reason why all those great ESPN journalists haven't been criticizing Dana the last three, 4 months, when he was in a mode where you could actively criticize him. You remember this?
I've had a great run, right? If the coronavirus is what's going to get me, let's do it. Bring it.
I'm okay, ready, like yep. That deserves criticism. They couldn't say it. I'm assuming they couldn't say it. And look, I used to work for ESPN. There were certain things I couldn't say publicly. There's probably things under the Showtime CBS flag that I shouldn't say and wouldn't. I get that. I think it's different when somebody's doesn't work for you and they're there to cover. But I just hope that is not where we continue. We're going to take a pause for the cause, Rashad. On the other side, we got Matt Mitrione stopping by. We got a preview of a Wednesday night card that we need to see, UFC Jacksonville Fight Night, after a quick word from our friends and sponsors. Dig it.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
All right, we're back. BC, Sugar, Rashad, we're going to bang.
Let me bang with somebody.
All right, we bring it. Speaking of, before we get into the preview, we got Matt Mitrione stopping by. A couple bits of news I want to run by you here, Rashad. What the hell's going on with USADA here? Our guy, Kelvin Gastelum, I love that guy. What he did against Israel Adesanya in that loss and that fight of a lifetime, I'll always have respect for him. You know, getting himself to that level, got a second failed test for marijuana, and now he's got to sit out 9 months. Oh. Whole years just for weed? Damn! Rashad, times have changed fairly quickly. You're on Joe Rogan talking about psychedelics, and while a year ago people might have been like, this is wild, now there's like legitimate medical backup of where this could help PTSD. Like, we are in a new space with things right. Like marijuana and potential medicinal drug uses, or even if it's not medicinal at this point. The guy's a fighter for a living. Can he get high after work? Yes. Can he take down a six-pack? It's all the same at this point. What are we doing, USADA?
It's a true disconnect between, you know, what is it really actually working for fighters when it comes to rest and recovery and what they deem effective, you know, and everything like that. There's a huge disconnect because when fighters get done from training and we get done from sparring, THC, CBD, those are the things that help us to help with inflammation, help with anything that we have to help us recover so we're able to do it again. So I think that, you know, it's not so much just about getting high. It's about being able to recover the body the best way without taking anything that's going to make you pop, you know, dirty with you know, in any hormone altering.
Right. And you're in the business of aches and pains. You're in the business of the fight game, of training your body and working it hard. Like, I feel like this type of crackdown only opens the door for more like opioid addictions and more like wrong direction to turn.
Agreed. Yeah.
And I know there's probably some big pharma conspiracy crossover there that we should probably not talk about right now. But all I'm saying is this, he was in the state of California where it's damn legal. Right. Like, come on, UFC, and you shot it. Be progressive at this point. What the hell are we doing? I don't know if he's going to fight that. I hope he fights it. I feel like I want to go fight it for him. Like, come on.
Some states have different allowances of what they'll let you go get away with. Like, when I fought in Vegas, you know, I had to stop smoking like, I think it was like a week before the fight. And then in Chicago, I wasn't able to smoke. Like I had to stop smoking like a month before the fight because it would stay in your system. So it's what each state allowed, and it depends. You have to know which state you're fighting in, and it'll let you know what you're able to do as far as the THC consumption in your body.
Absolutely. This blew me away. This was just not something I expected to be reading there. Wow. All right. I'm trying to see what else I missed for, I think we hit it. Oh, speaking of standing in the Hall of Fame, our boy GSP, I am impressed by your
I'm not impressed by your performance. I'm impressed
by your poor performance there, GSP. He's going to go in the class of 2020 this year at some point. They're not sure when it's going to happen. He's going in the modern era. He's the name and the face for this year's class. We know you love and respect this man. Of course he deserves it, but you got any GSP stories? You got anything extra?
Oh, my gosh, GSP stories. I got a ton of GSP stories. Some I can't share. Most of them I can't share. But one time GSP, you know, GSP was deathly scared of aliens, you know. And when Greg Jackson had his first come, like whenever you come to Greg Jackson's camp, he would have you stay in his house. And just so you get to know how you are as a person. So Greg had this room where it was like a sky roof, you know, with like a hole in the ceiling, you know, where you can see outside, you know, sky dome over the room. And GSP sleep in that room. And then the next day I talked to him. I was like, how was your sleep last night? He's like, my God, my friend, I got no sleep. And I was like, why? He says, well, because I kept having these thoughts that the aliens would fly over the house and pick me up through the windows. And he was going on and on talking about how afraid he was because he's afraid that the aliens were going to abduct them through the sky windows. At Greg's
house. You should shut up. You're embarrassing yourself right now. Are you still drunk right now? Are you still drunk? Or what's going on?
No, but I'm not.
What is going on with him?
That was weird, by the way, hearing him talk trash, trying to talk trash with Bisping. That was crazy. But, man, I love that guy. You know what? I know, like, he'll go in for his greatness, for his consistency, maybe the first real well-rounded mixed martial artist at the elite level. There's so many things you could talk great about him. But how about just his clash and professionalism? Like, he's like – that's why I get mad when Dana wasn't into the idea of him – having a chance to become the first three-division UFC champion by fighting Habib. And look, I get Dana's point was you're going to win another belt and then drop it on us and not defend it. But, like, that's the one guy that, like Jerry West is the NBA logo. GSP, to me, should be the UFC logo. Like, that's your poster boy for how it should be done, Rashad.
I agree. You know, when it comes to just so many things with GSP, you know, but morality is one of the things that, you know, he is, in my opinion, you know, head and shoulders above the rest. You know, he's one of those guys who is just like one of the most caring fighters I ever met, you know, really good guy, give you the shirt off his back, just super caring and a hard worker at that too. And it's kind of crazy because you see like you know, the Michael Jordans, the Kobe Bryants, and they had that way about them of perfection, but they were kind of, they were dickheads, you know what I'm saying? Like they weren't nice people, you know? And it's great and it's refreshing to see someone who reaches the standards of GSP and that perfection and still be a good person and still, you know, talk to people with respect and not be a dick.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. Other quick bit of news. In light of the Cejudo retirement, Dana White was quoted late Saturday and saying, we're gonna move quickly and get a vacant bantamweight title bout going, and it will be Peter Yan against somebody else. Who do you think that somebody else should be in an already crowded division? And I know Yan already had a fight scheduled. Do you remember against, was it Moraes? Was it
Moraes?
Who do you think it should be for this vacant bout?
Oh man, I kind of like Aljo.
Yeah, he's deserving.
I kind of like Aljo. I just feel as if like I just feel like Aljo is now getting to that, like he's there. He's there now. You know, he's ready. And I think that Peter Yan is phenomenal. And just, you know, there, I think that Peter Yan, Aljo may bring out some levels in Peter Yan that we haven't seen, you know, the ground and the grappling aspect that we really haven't seen of Peter Yan. So I think that it'd be a good fight.
The last bit of news was Bryce Mitchell. That's the guy's name, right? The
oh my who goodness.
Looked the featherweight, the unbeaten 25 years old from Arkansas, Thug Nasty, who looked insanely great in against Rosa on Saturday. Like he tried, he was up in that ass. I mean, he was trying to get a submission, twisters. I mean, he was doing everything. But afterwards, he made headlines by saying, "I want to get the coronavirus. Like somebody inject me so that my body can become immune to it." Rashad, I know you don't have that degree yet in epidemiology, but is this guy talking sense or what's going on here?
I don't know. I don't even know, man. You know, I don't know. That's one to unpack there. You know, I think is, I don't know.
Yeah. Shout out to Mitchell. He did have a hell of a performance there. All right, we're going to throw it to Matt Mitrione. He's going to tell us about this collaboration between Bellator and CBS Sports. He's going to relive his journey in that Grand Prix last year. He's also going to talk a lot of trash about how much he hates that, quote, fat vagrant Roy Nelson. So get ready for this coming at you right now. It's Matt Mitrione. Enjoy. Give me the meathead. Give me that Bellator heavyweight sensation, Matt Mitrione. Sir, how are you holding up during this quarantine?
What's up, baby? What's going on, man?
I mean,
I'm holding up great, man. I got a house I'm doing a little bit of work on. I always do that when I get kind of bored. So I'm in here just working on my house, brother, just hanging out, living the dream.
All right. I like that. I like that indeed. You know, Matt Mitrione, a great way to kill the quarantine, so to speak, maybe that's the wrong word, is watching some old fights. And we got a nice little collaboration here between CBS Sports and Bellator MMA. We're calling it Bellator MMA Recharged on the CBS Sports Network. Big John McCarthy's your host. Kicks off April 25th on a Saturday night, every Wednesday night after that, 8 p.m. Eastern. And we're going to give the fans Matt Mitrione versus Roy Nelson in a nice replay from that Bellator World Grand Prix heavyweight tournament. I mean, I could think of a worse way to kill the quarantine than catch up on some old badass fights. What do you remember about that little contest?
You know, what I remember most is that I got to kick the shit out of that bloated vagrant, and it felt so good to punch and kick him in his face and his legs. Like, just it was such a lovely experience. I'm not a big fan of Roy Nelson at all. So literally causing him damage felt mighty, actually pretty nice, actually, all around.
Well, that, of course,
it was nice. And then on top of that, to beat him, it felt even better.
Absolutely. That was a rematch of a rivalry that went back to 2012 when he got a win over you in the Ultimate Fighter finale. Then you two traded some trash talk back and forth even after. Are we ever going to see a third fighter? Or no need for that. No need.
No, he got his ass kicked pretty early in this one. I'm not really interested in it. Plus, like, the bloated vagrant actually cheated to try to beat me, and he still lost. So in my opinion, he can go straight to hell. I have no time for him, and look, man, if you're going to try to cheat to win, then that's your fault. But if we're actually considered friends before that, and then you cheat in the middle of a fight against a friend, then you're just a douchebag, in my opinion. So I'm glad I got to whoop that blooded, that bloated piece of trash, and I'm glad he lost. That's pretty much how I feel.
That's the thing. People don't realize Matt Mitrione's one of the best quotes in all of MMA, right? I mean, come on, you know, just slinging it and bringing it here. Matt, we've seen a lot of crazy reactions to this odd time off. You know, some people think we should be fighting tomorrow. Other people think, man, you shouldn't leave the house for another 18 months. From your standpoint, when you see Dana White, for example, trying to put an island together to make fights happen, are you okay with it from the fighter perspective? Is it time now to get back to regular life?
I think that Mr. Coker made the correct decision when he did to cancel what he did, because there were so many questions, so many unknowns, so many variables that were just not under control at all. And I think nowadays it's time. I think that it's each individual's decision. Okay, look, yeah, I'm down to go ahead and sign my name to this, and let's go ahead and get weird. And I think that if you're not cool with it, then don't sign the paper. Everybody's going to get tested. Everybody's going to make sure that they're healthy, which is what they did with us as well, and they still decided to cancel it. But I think now it's up to each individual's discretion. I know if they were to say, hey, look, we're going to be putting on fights in June, I'd say, okay, cool, let me fight the first weekend in June. Let me fight the last weekend in June. Let's start doing this. I'm ready to work, and I've got – being cooped up with your wife and kids, you know, makes you just ready to go out and start getting after it. So I'm ready, buddy. I'm ready to work.
Yeah, that is the truth on that sentiment you shared right there. Indeed, I even got manly and bought a chainsaw. I'm cutting crap down outside to try to kill this time. Indeed. In terms of the actual fight island, is that responsible?
I mean, you know, honestly, man, I don't see anything wrong with the idea. I don't know if, like, tangibly it can work, or logistically if it can work at all, which I think is why it got scuttled the first time. But I think that if it works, cool, man. It's a great opportunity for everybody to get another paycheck. But idea-wise, you know, Dana's a visionary, and he goes after stuff on certain levels, and if he can see it as a viable possibility, he'll do it. I know that Mr. Coker is Scott Coker, our president, Bellator's. He's a realist. He always has fighters in mind. So I think that they probably had a conversation about it and didn't feel like it was really a viable commodity and decided not to pursue it. But Dana is the one that typically takes risks and a little bit more adventurous.
Absolutely. You've had a really fun.
You got to remember something that all the paper and notes are coming due for WME. That's a big bill to have to pay. So if they're not raking in dough, then they're in some trouble.
Indeed. I think that is a big part of this this push to make it happen. And I do shout out Scott Coker, as you did, for paying those fighters that weren't able to fight at that initial card, which was canceled. As far as your career, Matt Mitrione, you're 41 years old, but you got into this game late coming off of your NFL run. You had a lot of high moments here. I mean, you knocked out Fedor Emelianenko in Madison Square Garden, for crap's sake. Who's next on your list? Where are you at in your career in terms of the challenges you want to face, what goals you still have? What's going on here?
You know, man, I'm fortunate where I really don't care that much. I really want to have the best opportunities. I don't win at all costs because I've lost my fair share, but I compete at all costs. So when they call me up and say, hey, let's go ahead and get down here, if it's worth my time, absolutely, man. Let's go ahead and get down. Let's see what's happening. So name wise and whatever else, you know, I would love the opportunity to fight Karatanov again. I feel like the first one was a shame what happened. Second one, he beat me fair and square. Like, granted, I had a mouthpiece issue, whatever else, but there was that dude's game plan that kept him patient, his boxing skill and ability. And that's why he caught me that uppercut, because he saw me get impatient and I rush in and he threw exactly what he should have thrown. I'd love the opportunity to scrap him again. But I doubt that'll happen. But other than that, man, it really kind of, whoever the boss calls up and says, hey, we think this is a good matchup and we think we're going to do it, cool, man, let's sign that piece of paper and let's get weird, you know?
I like that. Speaking of getting weird, when you made contact and kicked Karatanov in the stick, did you think he could have continued?
You know, I'd like to think that I throw some lumber in my left shin. So, you know, hopefully his, you know, well, he said that I kicked him in his left behind that he got a hemorrhoid out of it. So,
God.
I don't know. If somebody kicked me in that so hard, I popped a vein out of my butthole, I'd probably not fight either.
Wow. Wow, indeed. Matt Mitrione, we do a lot of work here with my good friend Sugar Rashad Evans on this podcast, the UFC Hall of Famer.
That, dude. He's such a damn good dude. I mean,
he's the absolute best. And I do remember him being your coach back on season 10, the heavyweight season of The Ultimate Fighter. What do you remember about that time working with Rashad?
You know, man, you know, so I still call him coach. I still call him Coach Rashad. He's such a good dude, bro. I really admire him as a human being. Like he's so much more than a fighter. He's educated. He's casual. He's an educator. He's patient. He's giving with knowledge. I mean, dude, he's such a good dude, and he's been so good to me and my family. And not even just me, but like young bucks in the gym. You know, it's difficult at times when you're experience in the game, right? And have done so much as Coach Shad has, that like you don't necessarily impart knowledge on people because you don't know if they're going to heed it or if they're going to be around long enough to make it worth your while to actually teach them. And Coach Shad, I've never seen shy away from investing in anybody, whether they're a newcomer or an old dog like Robbie Lawler or myself. They're always there, and he's always there to help and be the best team player he can be. And I think that's one of the primary reasons I admire him so much as a person.
Oh,
and that's what I take the most from him.
I can appreciate that for sure. Did he officially give you
the belonging endorsement, wasn't it?
That was, I mean, is he running for president here? That was fantastic. Did he in fact give you the nickname Meathead? Is that a Wikipedia fact?
He did not. I was named Meathead back in high school, probably when I was like 15 or 16 or something like that. My coach, Jimmy McMahon, D-line coach, gave it to me. But coach is the one that revived it and brought it out to the MMA world.
There it is. I like that indeed. I don't think we talk enough, sir, about your football career, you know, whether it be your success in the Big Ten in Purdue or with the New York Giants. What should people know about you, the football player, if they're MMA only and they don't get down on that side?
You know, I would say that I was a good college player. And when I got to the NFL, I realized that there are some people that are just such abnormally capable freaks of nature. And those are the people that stick around the NFL for a long time. I'm a damn good athlete, but those dudes that can play for a while and make a career out of it are just truly exceptionally athletic human beings. I mean, it is such a gift, to be able to play that sport for that long and get paid for it. But it is an incredibly different animal altogether to be good at that sport and to make a lifestyle and a retirement out of it.
Yeah, indeed. Do you have a favorite moment? I mean, when you bounce the kids on the leg and retell the football days, is there an Al Bundy four touchdowns in one game moment? What do you point to?
In the NFL, you're referring to, is that correct? Or are you talking about just in general?
You know, college, NFL, you know, whatever you got for me.
You know, I intercepted a pass against Michigan State. I tipped a screen pass to myself, intercepted it, and ran it back 18 yards. Touchdown, and I juked the quarterback on the way into the end zone. Wow. That would probably be my Al Bundy moment.
I love
but
that.
I had a bunch. We had some really awesome experiences. Like, I remember one with Drew Brees. That actually, I talked to Drew. Last time I saw Drew, I talked about it, and I told him the one play that I admired the most from him in his playing career, and that there was one player I could literally credit for making Drew the player that Drew is, other than Drew himself, like an outside player. And I talked to him about that. And it was cool, man. It was a good experience.
I like that. I like that indeed. I love the trash talk you were willing to share about Roy Nelson. But like we said, that rivalry may be over. Is there anybody else who is,
you know,
still?
You can call him a vagrant, a dirtbag, a bloated. You can call me anything you want.
That's fair.
Okay.
That's fair indeed. Is there anybody else that is still owed a receipt by Matt Mitrione. I mean, that guy, Hoppa Brown, puffed your eye up into crazy levels.
You know, no, because Travis was doing what Travis had done. He was, the fight wasn't stopped because my eye, those eye gouges. It was my fault because I said that I was going to continue. I knew it was my last fight in the UFC. It was my fault. I should have been like, you know what? I'm seeing double. I can't go and insisted on stopping, but I let my balls get in the way. And you know, it's just, so I'm not salty with Travis. I think Travis could have been mildly, more, apologetic about it, but I have no ill will towards him at all. I think that really, if somebody beats me, man, then good for them. I mean, they got the best of me on that night and it's going to happen. But other than the vagrant, I really don't have any ill will towards anybody, really.
Okay.
Most of us are pretty cool, as you would know, man. Like most fighters are pretty humble, pretty cool. And once you get a little too big for your britches, you end up getting your ass kicked in front of everybody that's ever seen the sport, and nobody can ever let you forget about it. So it's a pretty humbling sport pretty quickly.
I would have to think that's as humbling as it can possibly get. Speaking of getting their ass kicked, there was this door one time during your Ultimate Fighter season.
So why are you tearing down a door?
Were you there when that door got eaten by Rampage?
I was. That was actually after my fight against Scott Junk. That was my first fight ever, and I beat his boy Scott Junk, and Rampage was really upset about it.
Was that door made out of paper? What when we look back at it, or was that a legit door?
It was a hollow course cardboard door. And what's funny, like Dana actually said that what he's upset the most about that whole thing is that the world got to see what kind of cheap doors they use.
Great moments indeed. Appreciate you sharing that. Definitely looking forward to check out the Bellator MMA Recharge Series with Big John McCarthy. You want to see some Fedor fights, some Rampage fights, Matt Mitrione taking on a vagrant. Be sure to check it out. Debuts April 25th, 8 Eastern on the CBS Sports Network, and then every Wednesday night after that. Matt Mitrione, thank you for your time, sir, and for filling this quarantine hole with a few laughs.
Thanks, brother. I appreciate it, man. You guys have a great time, and make sure you watch me whoop that fat vagrant ass. Thanks, boys.
All right. Special thanks to Meathead. Rashad, I don't think it's part of that interview. We're going to play it later down the road. But he had some great things to say about you as a human being. What is your sort of history with Meathead?
Well, I mean, he was a coach on Ultimate. I coached him on Ultimate Fighter Show. And after that, he came down to South Florida and was on my team, you know. So we established a pretty good relationship, you know, and, you know, trained a bit. Matt is a good guy, man. He's been a friend of mine for a while, and, you know, he's a good dude, man, really good dude.
We're going to relive his comments and a lot of that when Storytime with Rashad eventually takes us ahead in that big Rampage fight when you did coach on The Ultimate Fighter.
So why are you tearing down a door?
Yeah, why are you tearing down a door? It was fun getting Matt's breakdown on that. He's like, yeah, that door was paper thin. Let's be honest with it, years later. All right. Did anyone save that? I'd buy that off eBay.
Rampage broke up.
This is a little bonus question. Did you ever think during the filming of that you may have to fight Rampage, like outside of the cage, like in the any of that?
Every day I went to on set. Because our times, our training times overlapped. Like sometimes if he ran his training schedule a little bit later, then it'll overlap on my time. So sometimes we would interact. And whenever we interact, it was always explosive. It got to the point where they pushed his training time so we wouldn't interact at all, because every single time we were going to fight, it got bad.
Whew. That was a great season. I mean, people forget that's the heavyweight season. That was like you have to tune into this crap.
Kimbo Slice season. Yeah.
Kimbo enough was to draw you in, but then when you had the Rashad and Rampage stuff going on, I mean, wow.
Hey, Rashad's nuts out your mouth.
Okay. That's fair, Rampage. All right. Rashad, let's break down Wednesday night's card. It's going to be on ESPN Plus. from Jacksonville, no crowd. And by the way, speaking of this no crowd thing, I actually thought it was pretty fun this weekend, Rashad, that there was a new element to deal with, and that's the fact that the fighters could actually hear the commentary for better or worse. We saw Carla Esparza be like, say she was offended that DC was kind of like ragging on her, but then started to use his like, she should be doing this and this to help her. You also had the fact that the judges could hear that and the fighters could hear their corners probably better than any before. How much do you think, for as long as this season's going to last, that might change some things? Because if you got a smart guy like DC sitting by the cage telling you what you're doing wrong, that might help you.
I mean, if you're a smart fighter and you're used to, and you're able to, you know, use your smarts while you're fighting, then that can help out tremendously. You know, when I was fighting Dan Henderson, he had a move, and I picked it up just by listening to his corner. I had no idea what it was, but this corner said Bisbing, and immediately I knew what he was trying to set up, the inside left kick to the overhand right, and I avoided it the whole fight just because I understood when he said Bisbing. So you can pick up on key words, and you can figure it out, and it can't stop. So, yeah, this may be an element that we have never seen before, but maybe one of the fighters use.
Yeah, it's wild. But this card is headlined, of course, by a really good light heavyweight bout. It's Anthony Smith. It's Glover Teixeira. Certainly, there's some title implications at stake here. Yeah. Glover Teixeira is 40 years old, but he's sort of recharged. He feels like he's back. He's on a 3-fight win streak. He submitted Carl Roberson, submitted Ion Cutelaba, and then won that split decision over Nikita Krylov last September, trying to make it back to the title shot. And Anthony Smith, of course, after that John Jones loss, blew away Alexander Gustafsson and sent him into retirement. Rashad, this had been a pretty shallow division because John Jones cleaned it out twice. I feel like there's fun again when you consider that Dom Reyes is right there. Yeah. Blachowicz is right there. And the winner of this may have a case to be right there as well. What are you looking forward to in this fight?
This is going to be a good fight. You know, it's Anthony Smith. You know, he has really good stand-up, and he has a nice frame too, you know. And if he can use that long frame with those long Muay Thai strikes and how he does – I think he can do pretty well. But the problem is that, you know, Glover Teixeira has been fighting a bit smarter. You know, he's not been going there throwing punches like he used to before. Now he's using more of a grappling, more of a grueling way of fighting, you know. And I think that's where Anthony may have a little bit of trouble because of the whole grappling aspect, because he's going to be outmatched on the ground when it comes to Glover Teixeira. So if Anthony can keep his fight on his feet, then I think Anthony has his fight in a bag. But if Glover can get this fight to the ground, then I think the fight favors more to Glover Teixeira.
Do you still owe Glover Teixeira a receipt? I mean, let's be honest here, Glover.
They both put my lights out. So, so I mean, I have no hard feelings about either one of these guys. You know, they both caught me with some good combinations or good punches or good whatever.
But, I love that you can laugh about that, Rashad.
laugh and crying. You got to laugh and crying, baby.
Exactly. I mean, it's not like you're not like in the Hall of Fame. I mean, you've been there and back. You've done it. I love this matchup because, you know, Glover's going to empty whatever he's got left. I feel like Smith should win. He's the younger, fresher fighter. You have to believe he's learned a lot from that John Jones loss. He's gone through some craziness personally with that home invasion recently. John Jones still chirping at him on Twitter here. How do you see this playing out? I like Anthony Smith to win a tough, hard-fought decision. Where are you going?
Man, it's tough, man. I like Anthony Smith too, but I don't think it's going to be I think it's going to be a tough fight for him, and I think it's going to be a tough fight just for the reasons that I spoke about before. I think he's going to have to deal with some of the grappling of Glover Teixeira in order to get the fight where he wants to on his feet, where he's able to capitalize on his reach and his striking that he has. So that's where I see the fight going.
Anthony Smith as an elite fighter?
Yeah, I think he is an elite fighter. I think that he's, you know, he's growing too as well too. I think that he's, you know, even despite the fact that he has, you know, like, you know, so many fights, he's still growing. You know, the process is still growing, and I feel as he grows in his process, you know, he will get better than he was when he fought John Jones.
Yeah, he's got 47 pro fights going back to 2008. It's really a wild story. I mean, there was a point in time where he was 9-7 as a professional. So that's wild. And he is improving seemingly each time we see him. Heavyweight co-main event. Big Ben Rothwell is back. But the interesting story here is OSP, Ovin St. Preux, moving up to heavyweight. And this morning, Rashad, he weighed in at 240 pounds. OSP getting husky on us here. OSP's a hit or miss guy, right? He's either going to get a spectacular knockout or kind of not really pull the trigger and maybe lose. Is this a desperation move to heavyweight? Is it inevitable for a guy with that size and power? What are you looking at?
I mean, I think that it was inevitable more than anything. I think that when you look at OSP in the past, he's always struggled to look, you know, to make that weight. He's always kind of a bigger guy. So it's interesting to see like what this 240 would bring to him as far as the energy standpoint, because sometimes you can watch a fight with OSP and he seems to be a little lackadaisical and not pushing the pace. And you wonder, is it because he's not in that good of shape or because he cut too much weight? So this fight would be the fight to see, okay, he may have had a weight cutting issue, and it's going to be good, interesting to see how he's able to utilize being able to have more energy or just being able to be, you know, maybe the faster fighter in there with these heavyweight guys, you know? So this could be something big for him in his career, because I think that when it comes to the heavyweight weight class, there's not a lot of fighters who, I think he matches up well with a lot of the heavyweights that we have right now.
Yeah, that gap between light heavy and heavy still seems to be pretty big. Whereas, like we always talk about it, heavyweight age doesn't really matter. OSP's 37. He kind of could find second life just from the fact that he doesn't have to deal with the speed at 205 as much, and we know he can bang. He also has 3 Von Fluchoke victories in the last 5 wins for him. So something to think about.
And also, I mean, talk about saving your fight career, not cutting so much weight. It saves your fight career big time.
Absolutely. Big Ben Rothwell snapped a 3-fight losing skid when he knocked out Stefan Struve in December. He had missed upwards of almost 3 years, of course, with the USADA suspension that came right after he seemed to kind of be looking like a legitimate heavyweight title contender. And then he got blanked by Junior Dos Santos in that 5-round decision loss. Big Ben Rothwell's a weirdo, but you know, he's always interesting. He's got a good submission game. He says weird things in front of a microphone.
Right now, there is not a man in this planet that can stop me inside this octagon, and only politics can slow me. I don't have much left to say other than you have seen nothing yet.
All right.
You like a maniacal laugh?
It fights up for grabs. We'll see. You know, I'm hoping OSP can put something together and kind of make a little bit of a run for himself, kind of like, Beefy Latifi might be able to do at heavyweight with a different game plan, a different way to look at things now. Good lightweight bout. Alexander Hernandez, Drew Dober. Alexander Hernandez, we still don't know. He might be the real deal. 11-2 record, only loss in the UFC came against Cowboy Cerrone when he kind of came out there like an a-hole looking to bang, and he ended up losing and getting caught in that second round. How good is Alexander Hernandez in your eyes?
He's really good, but I think that the fact that he lost the way that he did, it was the medicine that he needed at the time. You know, sometimes when you're feeling yourself, a little too prematurely, and you need to be sat down, as the case with Francis Ngannou, you know, and we've seen what happened from there. So I think the same thing can be said about Hernandez too. You know, I think that was, you know, what he needed in order to get his mind right about competing. So, you know, sky's the limit for a guy like he has. He has so many attributes, you know what I'm saying? He's a physical specimen. The kid looks great, and he has good skills. So if he can all put it together, but put it together mentally, then he can be a force.
And Drew Dober coming off of 2 knockout wins. This should be a very interesting fight to try to make some noise in the back half, the 10-20 area of the lightweight rankings. Good bantamweight bout too. Former flyweight title contender Ray Borg, who missed weight in his last bout, moves up officially to bantamweight, taking on the mullet wearing, always fun Ricky Simone. Could Ray Borg have new life at bantamweight here? What are we doing here, Ray Borg? What do you think about this matchup?
I think it's a good matchup. You know, Ray Borg is so tough, you know, and, you know, you see him at 125, and he always had a skeletal look in his eyes as if like he may have cut too much weight. So it's going to be interesting to see him at 135 and being a bit fuller and being a little bit more in the gas tank as far as not having to cut that weight. So he could actually make an impact at 135 and bantamweight. You know, it'd be interesting to already add to an already stacked division. You know, this could be It could be a big for that division.
Yeah, and Simone needs the winnies on a two-fight losing skid, which included Mr. Faber's comeback. The opening bout on this main card, I'm very interested in. Carl Roberson is going to move down from light heavyweight back to middleweight, and he's going to take on Marvin Vettori. And this is a name I feel like we don't talk about enough. The Italian is 26 years old. He fought Israel Adesanya to a very close split decision loss in 2018, had many moments in that fight. Since then, he's claimed decision wins over Cesar Ferreira and Andrew Sanchez. Could Marvin Vettori be the middleweight sleeper, Rashad, that no one is talking about?
Yes, he very well could be. You know, when you're taking the style bender, you know, to the decision in a very close fight, you're doing some things right, you know. And the fact that he's hiding under the radar, it lets me know further that he's doing something right. Because when a guy's riding on the radar and he's that competitive and that tough, you know, it's really hard to plan for that guy, you know. And it's going to be interesting to see what Carl does, because Carl, you know, Carl, I used to train with Carl in Jersey. And when I trained with Corey Anderson and those guys. And, you know, Carl's really good kickboxer. You know, he has some phenomenal kicks, amazing left high kick. So this is a big test for him, pretty good test for him. And he's back down at 185. And this is the perfect weight class for him, because I thought that this is the weight class that he needed to be in the beginning.
On this preliminary card, a couple of decent fights here. Felipe Lins is going to take his 4-fight win streak from the PFL into UFC in his debut here against Andre Arlovsky. Interesting. See if he can make some noise there at heavy. I kind of like Michael Johnson anytime he's going to fight. I know it's the second chapter of the Michael Johnson career. He's in there against Thiago Moises. And Sajara Eubanks against Sarah Moraes. I don't hate that one either, Rashad, all right? Brian Kelleher back. He had a big win a couple months back as well. He's going to take on Hunter Azur. And you remember that guy, Chase Sherman? He's back from the BKFC, Rashad. He went 3-0 in island fights lately. Okay. Not Fight Island. Island fights.
Island fights. That's in Picola. That's in Picola. Okay.
Oh, well, yeah, the shout-out to Chase Sherman there. Shout-out to everybody. I'm fired up. Fights are back. Wednesday night fights. I don't think this is going to be a new thing or a consistent thing. I think this is part of just making a splash for UFC, getting back on the map. But I'm fired up for it. And, you know, we're going to have you covered, not just previewing it, but also Thursday. We'll be back breaking things down, looking ahead to the Saturday card. Also, Calvin Kattar is going to stop by. He had a win we didn't really talk much about, but he dropped that elbow to Jeremy Stephens' mouth, and that was pretty impressive, Rashad. That was a fun little fight there. Also, I don't think we can go any further without mentioning that undercard banger that happened between Nico Price.
Oh, my God.
The guy I'm talking about.
Luque.
Vicente Luque. Oh, that was some fun freaking fire right there. Shout out to those guys.
Amazing.
Damn right.
The left hook.
We going to see Rashad on any cards coming up? You gonna travel during this pandemic?
You know, I don't know, man. They're not too far from me, so I could maybe get the call, but I don't even really know how they're doing the whole analyst thing.
Yeah, they had a bare bones staff, no desk above the arena, just
bare bones.
Mrs. Benavidez, Megan O'Leary, shout out to Megan O'Leary, was roaming the arena, but that was it. But interesting stuff there. Sam Alvey, tough loss for that guy. All right. We'll get every match going one day with Rashad. Thank you very much. All right, shout out to you, Rashad. Thank you for being here. All the listeners on the State of Combat, Matt Mitrione, for stopping by. We back, baby. Big things ahead for this podcast. Love chatting with you. Rashad, any other messages for the people? Okay, can they find you? You got a set coming up at the Comedy Store. What's going on?
No, I'm good. You know, just you can find me here. You know, this is where I am at, and this is where I will be.
All right. Until then, I got two words for you people, okay? We out.
We out.
Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
You ready, Bob?
Well, all right.
Audiences are raving. Bob Marley is electrifying. It's the feel-good movie of the year.
You dig?
Bob Marley, One Love. Rated PG-13. Now streaming on Paramount+.